Are you talking to me?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's our turn here. 2 hours of clear-thinking Christianity on Stand to Reason. So glad you joined me today. And I am joined in studio by my wife. And guess who? Little Annabeth Noel, now 7 months and 3 days old. Hello, sweetheart. Why don't you hand it to me? Now, I don't know if I can get this little girl. She's looking at the mic. Remember last time you were here, honey? 7 months ago. You were just a little squirt squeaking. Now you can laugh and gurgle and coo like a... What do you think? What do you think? Can you say something? Go ahead. I have to make these little baby sounds to get her to react. Now she's just looking at me. I hear a little breathing there. Oh, what is it? Huh? Huh? Oh, now she's chewing on the microphone. Okay, that's her contribution for today's show, ladies and gentlemen. But now, if you can get a little bit more talkative, sweetheart, I'd be glad to put you on and hear what you have to say. Ooh, now I hear a little grunt and a groan from the distance. In fact, she's ready to start laughing at Papa now. Okay, we'll have to save you for later. That's Annabeth Noel's second time on the air here, her debut being 6 or 7 months ago. We have more, I think, profound things to discuss today, though. In fact, I've asked a friend of mine to come on the air and to talk about something that has been a deep concern to me for quite a while. Did I say I'm Greg Kokel? Did I say that? This is Stand to Reason with you every Sunday, 3 until 5. Thank you for that, ladies and gentlemen. And my friend, a good friend, who I haven't seen in a long time because he has been engaged in very important work and has a passel of kids now, Mike Horton. Mike, welcome to the show.
Greg, it's great to be with you, although you can say the same, and it's going to be, in terms of being articulate, downhill from Annabeth Noel.
Listen, I understand you are like Super Dad.
Well, you know, I think my wife is definitely Super Mom. We have a 3.5-year-old and triplet two-and-a-half-year-old.
Somebody told me about this. I think I was down in San Diego, and I ran into one of your students from Westminster, and apparently you're really putting those guys through the grind on an academic basis on postmodernism, which is great, which is one of the reasons I, you know, when we come on to these difficult issues, I want to tap you out for your insight. But he told me that you'd had triplets, and I thought, holy cow, boy, that guy moves fast.
I'm taking it out on the students, really, my frustration.
Well, all the best to your wife, you know, and we've got to get together and have our kids play sometime.
Absolutely.
And just have dinner because it's been too long. I don't know if the audience knows this, but I actually cut my teeth on Reformed theology in Mike Horton's spa chewing on a cigar.
I was just going to say, we're getting the jacuzzi fixed.
Yeah.
So we're going to have you down.
Oh, that would be great. And I just realized as I was reflecting on it, Mike, that's the best way to learn theology. You know, that's a perfect kind of environment. I don't imagine that's what you have set up over there at Westminster, though, where you're now a professor. But
Well, J.I. Packer wrote that book, Hot Tub Religion.
Oh, that's right, he did.
Ever since, it's had a bad connotation. But in California, at least, I think...
It works.
It works.
Yeah. Mike, of course, professor at Westminster Theological Seminary, host of the well-known White Horse Inn radio show, which is... You actually did, the pilot right here in this studio many years ago, and so now you're still on, and it's well-liked all over the country. Editor-in-chief of Modern Reformation and minister with the United Reformed Church in North America. And, Mike, you have been tracking a bit with this whole emergent church movement. And I know I don't think you've written on it at length, a book-length piece on it yet, but I know that you've been tapped out for interviews and you've made a contribution, and this is something that I think you've thought through quite a bit, and I wanted to just chat with you here today to get some of your thinking about the entire movement and where you think it's going. In fact, maybe that's a good place to start. What from your perspective, and I'm going to try not to poison the well here, at least at the beginning, with my own ideas, but what is the emergent church, and should we, as Christians in the evangelical tradition, be concerned about it?
Mm. Well, I got interested in this, first of all, because I had some friends who were in it, and there's a real concern to recover a lot of the strengths that maybe have been lost in especially the mega church movement.
Mm-hmm.
These are young folks who whose parents were sort of into the more seeker-driven approach, and now these younger folks say, I want more substance. I want something that's older than the
70s or 80s or something.
And they want to connect to something. They want to belong to something.
Something more authentic, something with more depth in one sense.
Authentic pops up again and again as one of the criteria. They don't want 8 principles for this and 6 steps to that, and they know life is a lot more complicated and harder than that.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of things that have drawn me to it and that I find really attractive, and then also some trends that make me a little concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a pastor myself, a younger pastor, I wanted to read about it, learn about it, and I've been a part now of some of their internet discussions. We did a White Horse Inn program, including interviews with Brian McLaren,
who is one of the leading publishers, writers in this area. In fact, I think he's just got another book out that I saw on the racks, and it just seems like he never stops. He's producing these books,
right?
Just one after another. A New Kind of Christian, The Last Word, and The Last After, and The Word After That. A Generous Orthodoxy, which by the way strikes me as kind of a. It's either a contradiction in terms, or it's a redundancy, because if something is really orthodox, it's already generous.
Well,
it's appropriately generous, you know. You don't have to fix it up if it's really orthodox.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about Brian McLaren is I've spent some time with him just personally, and I think a lot of him personally, but my concern, we can get into concerns if you want later,
mm-hmm.
but my concern with generous orthodoxy particularly is that, at the end of the day, I know he's after a sort of generous orthodoxy, but my conclusion, at least in reviewing that book, is that it doesn't really meet its target of being either generous or orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying
mm-hmm.
so hard to, it's this American sort of revivalist restorationist tendency to create a new movement that doesn't have a denominational connection.
Mm-hmm.
And
which they don't want to call a movement even. They're sensitive to that term. They just want to call it a conversation.
Exactly. Just a conversation, and yet, pretty quickly, it evolves into something like, that looks like and acts like a church. And one of the things he's trying to do is bring all of the best from all of the different traditions, including liberalism,
mm-hmm.
into, quote-unquote, conversation. You know, we have a lot to learn from the liberals. And Brian McLaren says,
mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm of the opinion that we have a lot to learn from Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox and Anabaptists, a whole host of.
Well, he calls himself a Calvinist, an Arminian, a fundamentalist, a Catholic, and he uses all these terms to characterize himself. But at the same time, he has very, very unusual ways of defining almost all of these terms. I get frustrated reading him because it's so hard to pin him down as to what the heck he's talking about. And that in itself, given that this man is a leader of a movement that is seeking, I mean, let's face it, I think it's fair to say, to reform the church,
yep.
And is unwilling to be pinned down to particulars, yet will put all kinds of particulars in the mouths of his characters that inhabit the narratives he writes.
No, that's really true. In fact, that's why I critique generous orthodoxy as neither generous nor orthodox at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not, first of all, it's not generous, Greg, to say to a Roman Catholic, for instance, my new denomination that I'm not calling a denomination or movement that I'm not calling a movement wants to take the best of Roman Catholicism, but only at the expense of whatever's left not being really Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking, for instance, here's what he does to Calvinism. He says, I want Calvinism to be a part of it too, so long as Calvinism isn't defined by what Calvin or the Reformed Confession say Calvinism is.
Yeah, and he's got a tulip, but he's got all different things for the different letters in the acronym.
Yeah, he redefines it as he goes along, and that's not generous, because generosity is saying, look, I'm not I'm not a Calvinist. He should just say that. I'm mm-hmm. not a Calvinist. Here's what I think is wrong with it. But I still think that we should have a conversation. Here are things that I think are good emphases.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for instance, when he talks about Catholicism, Anabaptism, and liberalism, he isn't really critical. When he talks about Calvinism, Lutheranism, fundamentalism, and other things that he doesn't clearly like, at least mm-hmm. in their traditional form.
Or in the forms that he's been exposed to.
Exactly. The forms he's been exposed to. He's very sharply critical. And, you know, I want to say, especially when he takes on board a number of liberal views of Scripture, of salvation outside of Christ, when he says, for instance, we don't need to my goal is not to make people Christians, to try to lead people to Christ, but to make them better disciples of Christ as Buddhists and Hindus.
Yeah, but see, this is one of those statements that is obviously it makes people pick up their ears, and I think this is what he's after in his kind of aggressive and literary style. I mean, this is part of his technique. But this is when you think, well, wait, what the heck do you mean by that? Do you mean this or do you mean that? Do you mean I don't want to make them better Christians if what we mean is this kind of a boxy fundamentalist kind of culturally contrived Christianity? Or do you mean that they want to become good Buddhists that are in some strained way, maybe in an inclusivistic way, are unconscious Christians and are still saved by the blood of Christ, even though they believe in Buddha and the whole Buddhist worldview? And this is where he won't come clean, it seems to me. And it's so frustrating to me, Mike, because when I read his things and I listen to what he has to say and how he answers questions, I get the feeling he's either and maybe this sounds uncharitable. I try to read him charitably, but after a while I start thinking he's either disingenuous, he's stupid, or he's lying.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he's not stupid. And so, like when he says, for example, somebody's trying to pin him down, are you an exclusivist or not? Do you believe that Jesus is necessary for salvation? You got to believe in it. And he says, well, I don't really like the exclusivist term because Jesus wasn't about excluding people. He is about including people. Now, this, of course, is, I think, a clever kind of equivocation because exclusivism doesn't mean we're excluding people.
No.
It means we're excluding false messiahs.
Right.
And
which Jesus himself arguably had pretty strong views of.
Yes, of course. Yet see, he maintains – does he really think that exclusivism means excluding people? I can't believe he believes that. But then why didn't he just answer in a straightforward way?
Well, again, I think, you know, he creates a straw man of evangelicalism and, you know, the worst caricatures, some of which are you and I have encountered, but certainly not the mainstream of evangelicalism. He takes a caricature of evangelical, traditional, sort of conservative Protestant Christianity
mm-hmm.
and reacts so viscerally against that. And he says, you know, don't tie me down. I don't have a theology that is as dogmatic as all of these other theologies. But in fact, it is very dogmatic.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, for instance, it's not that he doesn't have a theology of salvation that drives him to quote-unquote inclusivism. He believes that basically redemption is a matter primarily of following the example of Christ, which mm-hmm. is why he says he likes the Anabaptist emphasis,
mm-hmm.
not on Christ as Savior from sin through a vicarious substitutionary atonement,
mm-hmm.
but by following Christ's example. Well, if that is how Jesus saves, primarily as we follow his example, then arguably a Gandhi or a Muslim who is sort of more liberal in his politics
mm-hmm.
is, in McLaren's view, a follower of Jesus more than,
mm-hmm.
let's say, a Christian who takes a strong stand, for instance, against homosexuality.
Right. This sounds to me more like Pelagius, by the way, theologically.
There's a lot of, there's a real weak doctrine of sin,
mm-hmm.
and if you ever have a weak doctrine of sin, as you know, Greg, you're going to end up with a weak doctrine of grace.
Yes, that's right. And the cross is just going to go by the wayside.
Right.
In the same way. Now, we've been talking, of course, we started out talking about the emergent church, and then we right away got on to Brian McLaren in particular because he is the most well-known spokesperson for the emergent church. Now, some people will say that the emergent church is very, very broad, and it's wrong to make any kind of generalizations at all about the theology characterized by emergent church people. Yep. We've chosen McLaren because he's the most vocal person, and he's really on record in if in some ambiguous ways with regards to his theology, his position, and his critique of the church. But other people that seem to be more moderate, say a Dan Kimball.
Yeah.
In fact, we're going to have Dan on next week, and Brett Kunkel will be doing the show then and interviewing him. And he has a book about the emergent church. And his view is that the definition of the emergent church, if I understood it correctly, is that an emergent church is any church that is trying to reach out to the emerging culture. Now this strikes me as so broad to be almost useless.
That would certainly encompass, at least in intention, the churches that I would hope I belong to.
I know. The ones that McLaren criticizes.
Yeah, yeah. No, see, this is the thing, and I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of emergent folks I'm talking to are saying, well, you know, we're trying to distance ourselves from – not everybody holds the views that Brian McLaren holds, but the problem is – The emergent movement now has its own brand. It has its own board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a movement. It's just a conversation. Then why does it have its own board of directors? And now,
when you say board of directors, you mean de facto or actually they've developed this an organization called the Emergent something?
Yeah, the Emergent movement, and it has a board of directors.
Oh, it's formalized now.
It's formalized now, and.
So much for the conversation.
Yeah, so much for the conversation. A couple of people I'm familiar with who've asked me not to mention their names.
I can see you're trying hard not to say
their names. Yeah, have said, you know, that leaders in the movement have said now, McLaren and others in the leadership of that on that board of directors are becoming pretty heavy-handed in excluding from leadership now people who have taken vocal positions against some of the views that we've just described as McLaren's views.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, once again, you look back at the history of the Campbellite movement, of, you know, the every restorationist group in America, they always start out egalitarian mm-hmm. and free enterprise, and then always end up more hierarchical and really owing allegiance to one person or a group mm-hmm. of people than the traditional churches that they left for being mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. hierarchical.
They start the non-denominational denomination, basically.
Right.
And, well, look, when we come back from break here in just a moment, I want to – because there has been this fuss about the emergent is so broad, there's so many different ideas that are represented, you can't pin me with what he believes, you know, I don't believe – you're misrepresenting me. They say that all the time. I sometimes get the suspicion that if you don't agree with them, then you don't understand them from their perspective, you
right.
know. So there's no way that you can criticize them in an even-handed, fair-minded way that they're going to acknowledge as a legitimate criticism or a fair shot.
Well, also, you're going to be painted with the brush of modern.
Yes, that's right.
The greatest shibboleth today, at least within that movement, seems to be, and I think this is a criticism that can be made of a lot of people, although in the conversations I've been a part of, some of the leaders have backed down and said, yeah, we've done too much with modern versus postmodern, it's too easy to simply identify everything we like and agree with as postmodern mm-hmm. and everything we don't like as modern, then we don't have to actually interact.
Right,
with
and that's what's
happening.
I think
they're developing some sophistication and maturity that Brian McLaren himself may not be motivated.
Well, that's good. When we come back, let's talk about this modern-postmodern distinction, because this is part of the dialogue. In fact, it is at the core of the philosophic differences that the emergent church has as it contrasts itself with the old-time evangelicals, the post-evangelicals, them, to the evangelicals of yesteryear who are basically out of step. And so since this comes up, and I think sometimes they don't understand neither modernism nor postmodernism. Maybe you can say a thing about that. And then I want to offer a model that might be useful to critique these things. Mike Horton is my guest here. We're talking about the emergent church. And by the way, stay with us for next week, too, because we will have Dan Kimball, one of the leaders of the emergent church, on this show. And Brett Kunkel, who will be sitting in for me while I'm out of town, will be doing the interview that day. So that's next week. But coming up just a moment, more with Mike Horton here on Stand to Reason.
Tired of defending your faith with "the Bible says so," "does too," "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-making and the will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today here on Stand to Reason, with a rare kind of appearance of my good friend Mike Horton. You might know Mike from the White Horse Inn radio show, from Westminster Seminary, or from Modern Reformation, which he is the editor-in-chief. He's written, boy, the list of titles here goes on and on. Putting the Amazing Back into Grace is one of the earlier books that that had a great influence on people's life, Mike. You wrote Beyond the Culture Wars back then, too. Lord and Servant, A Covenant Christology. Confessing Theology for Postmodern Times. Given that title, we are talking a little bit here about the emergent church, which many have said have taken on postmodernism as an accurate view of the world? That somewhat a contradiction with postmodernists, but I think that's the way they treat it. And that has deeply influenced their theology, and now it's influencing the church as well. So let's talk for a little bit about the postmodern-modern comparison here and how this plays out in this discussion, Mike.
Well, first of all, in my own discussions with the emergent folks, especially Brian McLaren, one of those, in fact, is published by Zondervan in the Emergent series. I tried to make the argument that, the categories for Christians, because ever since Pentecost, we take our cue from the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the sending of the Spirit, not mm-hmm. from the tearing down of the Berlin Wall and the advent of Jacques Derrida.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, history is divided between this age, as Jesus and Paul made the contrast, and the age to come.
Mm-hmm.
The age to come has dawned in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And in this present evil age, as the New Testament talks about the time we're in, that age to come is breaking in on us through the church.
Mm-hmm.
This present evil age itself is fraught with chance and peril. Because of God's common grace, things aren't as bad as they could be. People can still have good ideas. But because of human sin, there is no golden age. So certainly modernity threw us no bones as Christians. The period we identify with modernity, or the modern period since the Enlightenment, was far more of a devastating assault on Christianity, at least visibly, than throwing Christians to the lions in the Roman Empire.
Right, because the power of the ideas that were birthed from Immanuel Kant and David Hume and the rest of them, that took God off the throne and put man on it.
Absolutely, defining everything in terms of a naturalistic presupposition. It's not that they proved that miracles don't occur, like the resurrection. It's that they started out as atheists, at least methodologically, and surprise, surprise, ended up with atheism. But postmodernism is a free-for-all. Postmodernism is such a broad category. It includes writers who I think have written brilliantly against these Enlightenment views of knowledge and so forth. But it also includes radicals who take that as an opportunity to say there is no such thing as truth at all, or access to final revelation. But then that's exactly it's that then is the consummation of the modern project, because Immanuel Kant said we have no access to the transcendental categories such as God. We can believe God exists, but we can't know anything about him. Well, in many respects, Jacques Derrida, for instance, the poster child of postmodernism in a lot of ways, just carried forward, radicalized that modern Kantian thesis, and it just shows you that a kind of a superficial view of history can really wreak havoc, because not everything in modernity was wrong just because it was modern. Not everything in postmodernity is right just because it's postmodern. We have to analyze in every case, taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, the extent to which we are held prisoner by either modern or postmodern presuppositions that keep us from reading the Bible clearly and faithfully.
So it sounds like you're saying something that I first heard Jim Sayer say in his excellent book on worldviews, The Universe Next Door, in his chapter on postmodernism. But I've heard others make this observation also, that really postmodernism, for all of its rebellion against the modernistic point of view, is really just simply the final step of modernism, or the natural outcome of modernism. It's the child of modernism in some very real philosophic sense, just playing out this as you just described, this Kantian perspective, and the notion that there ultimately all is perspective, and you can't know the world as it really is. Everything is constructed by something, and this is just a new wave of constructivism, now linguistic constructivism in the postmodern era. It's all just a story. It's narrative. But really, it's in many ways, it's not that much different from really what was around 200 years ago and 300 years ago.
Yeah, Immanuel Kant said that our concepts of the world shape reality. We have no access to the world apart from the way we construct that reality in our minds. Postmodernism rejects the in our minds part of that, but as you say, goes on at warp speed with the constructivism that says basically, the world isn't something that is a wonder, a creation from someone beyond, but rather it is simply an evolving autonomous intertext. What unites the secularism of both the modern and postmodern periods is this immanence. That is, this reality that we see and hear, this reality that we experience within ourselves, is the only reality that there is, and God, there isn't a transcendent God, and if there is, this God has not come to us to make himself known in any kind of clear way. And now, there are, again, there because postmodernism, like modernity, is so broad, there are, I could point to some postmodern writers who are classed as postmodern, whether they'd want to be or not, who, from whom I've learned tremendously. I've even learned from Derrida. We were corresponding.
Well, you're brighter than me if you can even understand what he's writing about, Mike. I mean, he's a toughie.
He is a tough one. And
by the way, Derrida is dead, just for the record, and that is not a socially constructed reality. That is a fact of the world as it is in itself. You know?
That happened.
The irony is as though these are the kinds of things that postmodernists deny, that there are facts of the world as they are in themselves. And I was wondering if you could just weigh in on this. Do you think when they're saying that there, as Lyotard has said, there's incredulity towards meta-narrative, okay? You know, just there is no story that tells it all, that really captures reality as it really is. Do you think when – and that, I think, is one of the things that ties at least the more corrosive portions of postmodernism that you and I are concerned with for theological reasons, it ties it together. And that's what people like you and I mean when we say – that postmodernists say there is no truth. There is no truth the way we usually talk about it. And I guess the question is that are they saying this metaphysically or just epistemologically? Are they saying there is no world out there at all to know, or are they saying that we are just locked into our own linguistic constructive habits – distorting the world so much that we can't know what it's like. The only thing we can know is what our language tells us.
Yeah, the even a lot of the radical ones. What I've concluded, at least for most of them, including Lyotard and Derrida, is certainly not an ontological nihilism. That is, that there is nothing, no reality outside of the mind, but that we can't. What they're advancing is an epistemological relativism.
Mm-hmm.
That is, there's a reality independent of the mind, but our only access to it is socially constructed. Now, again, I think Christians, you go back, you look at what these postmodern thinkers are reacting against, and you say, well, we don't have the kind of knowledge that Kant and Hegel and certainly Descartes thought we had either. So both modern and postmodern accounts of knowledge from a Christian point of view fail because, once again, they're grounded in human autonomy, that we start with the self rather than with God. If I am the ground of all knowing and being, or at least all knowing, there is no access to the way things are, because I am socially constituted. I am a person, a white male born in Southern California, living in Southern California with my own biases.
No, but there's a difference, isn't there, between being influenced by biases and things like that, which I think we would all acknowledge, and being captive to them such that you have no epistemological access to truth.
Yeah, I mean, what happens, for instance, a postmodern philosopher of science, even like Thomas Kuhn, could say that a paradigm in science can be overthrown by the discovery of something people weren't looking for, even.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's true, then reality has a way of throwing us off our horse.
Mm-hmm.
Reality has a way of saying, I don't care what your socially constructed presuppositions are, this is the way the world really is.
Yeah, Derrida's in a grave right now.
Right.
You know, one person put it this way, reality is what you bump into when you don't take it seriously.
Yeah, that's a great line.
You know, it injures people that don't take it seriously. And so this is what gives me confidence that even though our knowledge is partial, our epistemological access is somehow interfered with to some degree, it doesn't mean that we can't know anything.
Right.
And in fact, if we couldn't know anything, I don't know how we could survive a single day.
Yep. Well, and one thing you mentioned, Lyotard, on metanarrative, that postmodernism is marked by an incredulity toward metanarrative.
There's no big story, in other words. They don't believe there's a big story covering it all, for those not familiar with the terms.
Here's where I would want to question that a little bit. I think what I think what Liotard is saying is not that there is no mega narrative, but that there is, which is a big story, but that there is no meta narrative. In other words, what he has in mind there is the modern story, which pretends not to be a story. The modern story is, I can find the Archimedean point, and whether it's in reason or in sense experience, what have you, ideas, I can find an Archimedean point and have the very same knowledge that God has.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I deduce everything else that I believe from that indubitable position.
And now you're back to Descartes, though, and his foundationalism and his idea that knowledge requires indubitability, no possibility of error, absolute perfection.
Exactly. And I think that that is the story that pretends to be no story that Liotard has in mind, a meta-narrative that pretends to not be a story but is a story. Christianity comes out of the gate saying this is a story. It happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
There once was a time when God was not flesh. Everything interesting in Christianity is a story. Mm-hmm. Everything in Christianity is a claim about something that happened, not of eternal, indubitable first principles.
Right, right. That's true. And this is where it kind of reminds me of Lewis, who said that this is the myth that's true. It is a story, but it is not just a story. It starts in the beginning God created. It doesn't start once upon a time.
Exactly.
It isn't just a fabrication from our linguistic constructivism. It is an account, a story, an account told in narrative form about the way things really happened. And we are not at the center of that, the modern analysis, but neither are we nothing in this. Neither are we are we the creators, I guess would be a way to put it, given the postmodern view. So,
and Greg, that's why I think that this is a great moment for us to announce the greatness of the Christian story.
Okay, but what the EC is trying to do, the emergent church,
right,
and announce that greatness, but they're announcing it within the context of convictions about the legitimacy of the postmodern approach to the world.
Yeah, some of them definitely are. What I would like to say to some of these folks, though, is, hey, let's go back and if, for instance, I'm right, and I'm not the only guy. I picked that up from people like Merrill Westfall, the interpretation of Liotard. If that interpretation is right, we can say to postmodernists, all right, we get the critique of Descartes. We're with you 100%. All of our old pre-modern theologians said that God's knowledge and our knowledge do not intersect at any point.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I know anything, I know that thing, whether it's a flower or a bust.
Analogically.
Analogically. Mm-hmm. I know it like God knows it, but the similarity is always less than the dissimilarity because God is God and I'm not.
Right.
We've always said not only that our knowledge is partial, but that our knowledge is creaturely. It's mm-hmm. human knowledge. It can't be anything more than that. So, yes, it's a story, but it's a true story. It's something that happened in history, and we have access to that. There are still postmodernists afoot who believe that things actually happen in history. We can appeal to that and say, great, we buy that Descartes was wrong. Can we now talk about the word becoming flesh in the womb of a Jewish virgin.
Right. And it's too bad that they keep going back to Descartes, because I owe no allegiance to him personally. You know, I'd rather go back to Jesus.
Right.
And his philosophy of life and his understanding of truth and those kinds of things. So I'm talking with Mike Horton, and we've got to go to break, Mike. And when we come back, I have four kind of a grid here I want to talk to you about in terms of assessing these things. Mike, of course, from the White Horse Inn Radio Show and editor-in-chief of Modern Reformation, professor over at Westminster Theological Seminary, author of numerous books in defense of evangelical and reformed thinking. We'll be back with him and the topic, the emergent church, right after this. I'm Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith.
and these three self-directed studies will cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Greg Kochel, the host, with you every Sunday from 3 to 5, trying to give you something worth thinking about whenever we're together. Coming up the next hour, it's going to be open calls, 1-800-227-5278. It's the line there if you want to get in the queue. My guest right now is a good friend and erstwhile companion. We haven't spent that much time together in the last few years. He's married. I'm married. I got a kid. He's got a bunch of kids. And we both got lots of responsibilities, but maybe we'll make it work out here before too long, you know, just to connect with our families, Mike.
Hope so.
Yeah, so do I. Mike Horton, I'm trying to think of where to go here. Let me just put it this way. With regards to the emergent church, I personally am in defensive posture, okay? I hear things coming from the writings of people that associate with this movement that strike me as deeply corrosive to the Christian enterprise because they have bought into an aspect of postmodernism that is deeply hostile to Christianity. And so my first thought isn't, well, how can we make common cause with these guys and benefit from the good things that they have to say? I mean, that's in there somewhere, but it's not what's on my doorstep. Yeah. I'm most concerned about protecting the church, and I see that there's a lot of things that they are talking about that appeal to young people. There are sociological aspects of this, concern for the poor, the egalitarian kind of approach to things, the kind of mellowed out worship that, I mean, it's like it's not square and in boxes, it's kind of free-flowing. And there are all these things that are really nice that young people tie on to, but they, as I've said in the past, they've tied on to these things that look attractive, but they are part of this church because there is a philosophical baggage that kind of informs these practices. And I think the philosophical baggage is poisonous.
Yeah, here's the thing, I think, one thing for us to remember, and especially if there are emergent folks listening or reading this, to bear in mind, there's a reaction against the megachurch sort of boomer religion of their parents. And that's understandable, but we all have to remember that that sort of church growth movement was theologically driven by a whole host of things we could talk about if we had more time.
In which you wrote in critical fashion of at different times too, certain aspects of it.
Absolutely, yeah. And so I share a lot of the same concerns.
Yeah.
As a lot of these younger folks. But here's my concern. When, for instance, George Barna, a leading figure in that megachurch movement, church growth movement, said, we have to bear in mind the chief principle of Christian communication, the audience, not the message, is sovereign. And when he went on to write books on marketing the church and so forth, basically he imported, I believe, a worldliness, a worldly grid that was very modern into the church that has no place in the church. And now, here's my concern. My concern is that while even many of our emergent brothers and sisters are critical of the effects of that movement, they aren't sufficiently critical of, how did it get there? How did the movement they're criticizing get there? Are they not also sort of taking on board, sometimes uncritically, a postmodern ethos that is just as worldly, different, but just as worldly? Are they sufficiently grounded in the theology of Scripture to order their churches according to the Word of God rather than according to the spirit of the age, whether it's modern or postmodern?
Well, I'll tell you, my answer to that is, from what I've seen, no. They are not grounded. I mean, the youth of today, regardless of the postmodern, modern kind of issue, just across the board, the Christians are largely, and you know this, Mike, biblically illiterate. They are not in a position to do this. And I see people in that are leaders in this emergent church movement making the most ridiculous kinds of statements.
Well, a lot of them have no theological training and have a real aversion to formal theological education. They sort of fly by the seat of their pants in a lot of cases. And remember, this is the generation that raised itself. Here, sociologically, this is a great generalization, but it works, I think, for a lot of folks. This was the generation that came home. The latchkey kids came home because both parents were out working or playing, you know, with their speedboat and the friends or their third relationship since the last divorce. And these kids raised themselves. They came home, turned on the TV, or played their video games and so forth. No one taught them anything. Now they're saying, we want to be taught. We want to be grounded. We want something more. But the leadership isn't trained to provide that. So now you have the sort of the big brother in that home without parents running the church. You see the same thing happening in the church that basically happened on the sociological side in the home. What we really need, I think, is a group of young people who say, no, sorry, my formation in the Christian life, my discipleship, that's so important in the emergent movement, my following Christ is too important for me to hand over myself, my future wife and kids, and future generations to leaders who do not know how to exposit the Word of God, the original languages, do not know how to, don't know what heresy they might be reinventing because they don't know church history.
Or maybe not just dishing up the latest sociological fad in kind of spiritualistic garb, which
yeah,
I think...
This is not... Church for Starbucks is no better... The Starbucks generation is no better than church for Walmart.
Let me ask you a question. I have an assessment here, and as I look at some, and again, it's mostly like McLaren and those like him, and there are a lot of those guys that have those views in the emergent church leadership. And I look at what I can make of their theology and their kind of sociological views that come out of their theology. And I'll tell you what it looks like to me, Mike. It looks like this is indistinguishable from liberal theology when all the dust settles, except for it is motivated not by a modernist animus of the liberalism of the past, but by a postmodern animus and produces the same thing.
Yeah. But moderns had reasons why they hated Christianity. They walked away from it because they said, here are my arguments. I can no longer square my modern presuppositions about the world with my childhood faith. Postmodern, a lot of postmodern folks or a lot of emergent types, and a lot of, I should say, bracket this by saying a lot of emergent folks I'm talking to affirm the creeds and so forth, although some emergent leaders I've talked to don't. Even the Trinity, in one case of a well-known emergent leader, was deeply troubling. But the problem is, once again, what does this mean? It, once you flesh out what you believe and why you believe it, you know, how can you? It's one thing to say that we need to practice our faith, not just understand it. But what faith are we practicing if we don't understand and identify the particular kind of faith that we embrace?
Right. I mean, this is this kind of generalized statement. We just want to love Jesus. We don't want to get too particular about some of these things. But, of course, John Piper has written, Athanasius would say, which Jesus did you have in mind, you know?
There are a lot of Jesuses out there.
Yeah, that's it. You know, Arius just wanted to love Jesus, for goodness sake. It doesn't take you anywhere, you know?
Right.
And if they just want to love Jesus, by the way, and this is where I think they're often disingenuous, then they would just be on an island somewhere. They wouldn't be writing books and commandeering a movement that that is meant to change the church if they just wanted to love Jesus. You know, there's more going on here.
You know, we always liberalism. Old liberalism said the same thing. Old liberalism said, away with the creeds, away with doctrines, away with anything that smacks of certainty. And let's just follow the ethics of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of that going on here. But the problem is, if our problem as human beings is as deep and messed up as the Bible says it is, I don't need another example.
Mm-hmm.
I need a savior.
That's right. That's a good point, Mike. Listen, here's my little grid that I talked about earlier. When people say, you know, I'm emergent church, well, what is that? Is that postmodern? Is that modern? What? I don't believe what he believes. Fine. Let's get beyond that. All I want to know of anybody, Brian McLaren, Dan Kimball, anybody who identifies himself with this movement, just tell me what you think about four areas. And these are the four areas that I think have become under attack. De facto under attack with the more extreme versions of the emergent church movement. Did I just lose Mike? I did. We're going to try to get Mike back here. And I'll just keep talking. I don't know how that happened. But I have four areas, and I have four specific areas that I'm concerned with. And these are the areas where I think we are losing ground, or are areas that are being challenged or corrupted by many of the EC people. I think we got Mike back on. What happened, Mike? Did you hang up on yourself?
I should never be given a phone with that I can mess up.
I thought you were going to blame it on your kids. This is the perfect time to do that.
Fault.
Okay. There are four areas where I think theologically corruption is happening, and this reflects, of course, as I mentioned earlier, my defensive posture. So if I talk to anybody, so they don't say you're misrepresenting me or you don't understand, I'm not that kind of emerging guy, I'm a different kind of, I just want to know, okay, forget about the terminology. Here's what I want to know. What do you think about truth and knowledge? What's your understanding of the whole project? Can we know, do they believe in the legitimacy of truth as correspondence? Which that's just the way that it seems to me that Jesus virtually always used the term, and that religious truth can be known, and can it be known to be known? I mean, do we have knowledge about things? Second, what do they think of about the Bible? Do they believe in inerrancy, or is the Bible just some folk stories written by a bunch of shepherds sitting around a fire? Third, what do they believe about
the latter view, by the way, was expressly articulated to me by one of the leaders.
What I just said here?
Yeah, I'm not saying it's representative
of
everybody I've talked to, but one very prominent leader in the movement said
just what I said.
Just what you said.
Yeah, I'd heard something like that, and that's why I use those words. So the truth and knowledge, one. Two, the Bible. Three, the cross. Does their view at least entail substitutionary atonement? Mm-hmm. Now, I think they can think of other things, but it's got to at least entail that. And finally, the Great Commission. Do they believe in the requirement to communicate the gospel because people are lost without it? Or are they some type of inclusivist or even pluralist? Those are the four areas I care about.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that's a fair kind of grid to work with in talking with these folks?
Oh, yeah. You basically went through the Articles of the Creed. I think that there's a reason why the creed has worked for 2,000 years, but in substance for 2,000 years mm-hmm. because it is a thumbnail sketch. Not everything that I, as a Reformed Christian, would like every Christian to believe is in that creed. But I believe that people who affirm that creed are fellow brothers and sisters, even if we disagree on a whole
right.
bunch of other things.
Right.
There is a unity in the body of Christ, but that unity is doctrinal before it's anything else.
Well, then, based on that, then, would you say that some of these emergent leaders who seem to be taking exception with, if not all, at least some of these very critical things, that they're, in fact, are confused enough about the truth that they're not legitimately in the body of Christ? You
yeah.
don't have to name names, but just does that occur to you?
Yeah, it does, and that's why I'm so concerned. I do believe that my assumption when I approach these folks is that I'm talking to brothers and sisters who are reacting against this is a teenage rebellion
mm-hmm.
against a vacuous faith of their parents, which was four spiritual laws plus inerrancy,
mm-hmm.
and the view of evangelicals you get from Larry King Live.
Mm-hmm.
They're reacting against
right.
that understanding, whether it's a caricature or, in many cases, real. And the good news is a lot of these folks are actually incorporating, for instance, the Apostles and Nicene Creed in their services.
Because there's an ancient future kind of aspect to this movement.
Then the question exactly is, and I want to put the best construction on it, but...
30 seconds, Mike.
Is this part of the ethos, sort of the way, again, in postmodernity, the sociology of the mall, we pick and choose, and, oh, this is a nice dress, let's
yeah.
try this on, or, oh, that's kind of a new old thing we haven't used in a long time, or does it really determine what is believed and preached and practiced?
Mm-hmm.
How deep does this go? That's my big question.
Mike, it has been a treat and a pleasure to talk with you again. We've got to get in that spa. As soon as
yeah.
you get it fixed up, let me know.
I will.
And I'll bring the cigars. You provide the spa, and we'll have a good time together. Thanks so much for the time you provided today.
Always great, Greg. Great to connect with you again.
Okay. Mike Horton, host of White Horse Inn, radio show, and editor-in-chief of Modern Reformation and author of just countless books and making a tremendous contribution to the body of Christ. Next hour, open calls, 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Be right back with you here with hour number two on Stand to Reason.
Where do you get this nonsense?
All right, we're in hour number two, and that means all of you frustrated listeners who wanted to be callers can now vent your frustration on the phone. I always lock down the phones when we have a guest. It's just my habit. In 15 years of radio, I've almost never opened the lines. And that's just, I'm sorry. It isn't, I guess I'm being selfish. That's all. I get a great guest like Michael Horton, and I just want to talk with him about these things and give you guys the chance to listen over our shoulder, and I hope it was satisfying to do that. But now's the time to call in. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. If you're in the 714 area code, that's just right around the corner for me. 754-4150 is the local number there. Of course, you can call in on anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion. I mentioned when I was talking with Mike, by the way, that next week we are going to have Dan Kimball on. And if you kind of match Dan Kimball up with Brian McLaren, these are two authors in the emergent movement. I think what you're going to find is two significantly different postures towards the kinds of things that I've expressed concern, the question of truth knowledge, the question of the Bible, the question of the cross, and the question of the Great Commission. And so I hope you tune in to listen to Brett Kunkel's interview with him next week. That'll be the first hour, I believe. In the second hour, of course, Brett will be taking calls. Brett, one of our speakers here at Stand to Reason, is doing a bang-up job, and we're really proud of him. And M.A. Phil, a student over at Talbot, and so you'll be in good hands with him. But let's see, what else did I want to say before we – yep, 7 days from today exactly we'll be setting sail. Actually, from this moment we embark, 7 days from this moment. And so many of you who are listening to me will be on our first Stand to Reason cruise. Now, many of you couldn't make this, and you've told us that, and you were upset, and you couldn't get in time or whatever, and that's okay. It's not going to be the first time that we are going to have a cruise. It's not going to be the last time that we're going to have a first, last. What's the difference? You know, people know what I'm talking. It's not going to be the last time that we have. The first time isn't going to be the last time, I guess what I had in mind. But we'd like to do this next year as well. Can I tell them what we're thinking about doing? Yeah. Is that all right? Next year we're thinking about not the West Coast but the East Coast, specifically the Canadian Maritimes, embarking from either New York and Boston and then going north along the coast in the fall for 10 days along Maine down the Seaway to Quebec. And wow, that's a great trip, too. So, you know, if you couldn't make this one to Alaska coming up in a week, we can maybe see you in 06 in the fall. We'll see if that works out, but that's what we're shooting for. So that's a pretty good consolation prize, it seems to me. I had an interesting experience yesterday that I want to talk to you about that I hope will be an encouragement to you. As I lead off this, our second hour, and if you want to get in the queue, 1-800-227-5278. I spoke at a church in West L.A. and gave a seminar. It was a modest turnout. We had a really sweet time together, though, and it was especially significant to me because of two people that were in the audience, a fellow named Keith and a fellow named Tom. Now, the reason that Keith and Tom are so significant with regards to this being there yesterday, it has to do with the point I'm trying to make. 30 years ago, I met Keith. Actually, I met him more than 30 years ago. I met him before I was even a Christian. We used to play tennis together in West L.A. when I first moved to California, and he was a nonbeliever, and so was I. And sometime after that, I became a Christian, and then I ran into him on the UCLA campus 1977, I think, and we were doing campus evangelism projects back then. I was a brand new believer. We were doing like street evangelism and street theater and that kind of thing. And it was right by there by Royce Hall, and in the quad there. And to hear him tell it, I was the barker, and I was the one that was all crying, yelling, talking loudly, trying to gather a big crowd to see this event. And sure enough, Keith was there, and he watched the event, and I caught his eye, and I recognized him from tennis, and so I went over there, and I shared the Lord with him, and he became a Christian. And now 30 years later, he's still a Christian serving in his church, and that's a neat story. And so part of my point here is here I took one occasion to share Christ with this man, Keith, and that one attempt or one seemingly inconsequential gesture, I sat down and shared the four spiritual laws with him. It wasn't that big of a deal for me back then on campus. But that has significantly changed his life, that encounter, as he's been walking with the Lord for 30 years. But it's not just his life, but he, somewhere along the line, was in the 80s rooming with this other man named Tom, who is also in the audience. And Tom, I don't know if Tom came to know anything about me through Keith, because at that time I was a pastor over at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach, one of the associates, one of the 13 associates over there. In any event, Tom had been a fan of Dennis Prager's program at the time called Religion on the Line, in which you have a Roman Catholic priest, a Protestant minister, and a rabbi mixing it up for 2 hours on secular radio Sunday night, 10 to midnight, with Dennis kind of leading the way and prompting questions, and as he's capable, very capable of doing. And Tom wasn't satisfied with the quality of the Protestant ministers that were representing Christianity there, and so he wanted to see more conservative people. So he called me up, and he said, "Do you mind if I put your name in?" And I remember the night very distinctly. I was watching TV, maybe a movie or something, and I had a piece of pizza in my hand. And I didn't know Tom from anybody. And I'd never heard of Dennis Prager or Religion on the Line. He said, "Can I put your name in?" I said, "Whatever." And I put the phone down and went back to my pizza and movie. A week later, I get a phone call from Religion and Media. They want to book me for Religion on the Line with Dennis Prager. This was 1986 or 1987. I said, okay, I'll go on. To be honest with you, it was pretty nerve-wracking because I'd never done anything quite like this before. But I did go on, and that was the first of 26 appearances on Dennis Prager's show Religion on the Line over the next 3.5 years. After which, in the late 1989, I was asked by this station, KBRT, if I wanted to test for my own radio program, which I did, and they gave me a job, and I worked for them for about 8 years, and then kind of went off on my own but kept the same radio show, now under the auspices of Stand to Reason, now 15 years and counting on radio. In other words, this rather inconsequential thing that Tom did, he just hooked me up with Religion and Media, was absolutely pivotal in everything that followed. And in fact, it wouldn't be crazy to say that if Tom hadn't hooked me up there, I might not have started Stand to Reason. I don't know, maybe I would have, but there were all these things that ended up falling together so nicely and neatly and cleanly that helped move me forward and mature me as a Christian and as a Christian ambassador, and that gave me more name recognition and more ability to interact with people, and therefore more ability, because of this experience, to teach others how to do it. That had I not had all that experience, it might not have occurred to me to start Stand to Reason, or if I had, I would not have been in a position to offer as much through my experience as I was, because Tom made the call. Sometimes the biggest things hinge on something very small. You might have heard the old saw, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of the shoe, the horse was lost. For the want of the horse, the rider was lost. And for the want of the rider, the battle was lost. For the want of the battle, the war was lost. And for the want of the war, the kingdom was lost. All for the want of a nail. It's the small things. And you may be that small thing. Just like I was a small thing from my perspective in sharing Christ with Keith, and that led to his 30-year walk with the Lord and his relationship with Tom, who then did a small thing on my behalf that God then magnified, like the loaves and the fishes, to have an impact that it can't be counted this side of eternity. And the reason I share that story is I would like you to think of yourself as a Greg Kokel sharing with a Keith, or a Keith befriending a Tom, or a Tom making a phone call on behalf of Greg Kokel for Religion and Media, Religion on the Line. Small things. I'd like you to think of yourself as that nail. And just be there on the ready, or at the ready, to be used in whatever it is. I had a conversation yesterday with a 13-year-old girl at El Pollo Loco. It's one of our favorite fast food places. We were getting some food to take home, my wife and I. Little 13-year-old girl. I was holding my little 7-month-old Annabeth, and of course she's a crowd pleaser and makes a lot of friends. Very cheerful little baby. And this 13-year-old girl was also very friendly, and I started talking with her. Now, I did not have any idea where that conversation was going to go. I was just trying to be friendly. I was looking for an opportunity, a door that might open. And I don't know that much of a door did, but I do know that this young lady was a little bit timid, and she seemed to open up, blossom a little bit, as I showed her some appropriate attention and drew her out and asked her questions about her life and gave her the baby to hold, which she was absolutely thrilled to do. The point I'm making is I'm always looking for little opportunities. I'm not looking for the big TV jobs, the big 3, 5, 10, 50,000 people in an auditorium kinds of jobs. That's not where I'm going to have my biggest impact. I'm keeping my eye open for the little things. Now, sometimes I am on TV. Sometimes I am in large venues, and you are in neither of those probably. But there are a multitude of small opportunities that come your way. It's called blooming where you're planted, and you never know. When you are an ambassador for Christ, when that small opportunity that you take advantage of and you just give a cup of cold water, metaphorically speaking, in the name of Christ, when God is going to take that, and pardon me for mixing my metaphors now, but take that little loaves and fishes that you're offering, all that you have in the moment, and then he magnifies it to feed the multitudes. Friends, it happens all the time. We just got to be there. Scatter our seed, as it were. So anyway, that's my mini lesson for today. And since both of these men were in this small audience yesterday, it got me thinking about that. And it made me wonder, gee, even with this modest audience, who knows what God will do with that handful of people that I taught yesterday. All right, 1-800-227-5278. Let's go to our first caller. Tracy, hi. Greg Kokel.
Hi, Greg.
Glad you called.
Thanks. I had a question concerning lawsuits and how they apply biblically to our lives, meaning that if a lawsuit is considered a revenge sort of thing, and we're not to take revenge because
that's right.
God's thing mm-hmm. to do. But, speaking from, a human perspective, I would want to pursue a lawsuit for something. But is that something biblically that we are mm-hmm. to do?
Well, I'd make a distinction in different types of lawsuits, and the law doesn't make the distinction. These are distinctions of motive.
Right.
And you've just mentioned one. Sometimes there are lawsuits that are brought against another party. Are you talking about between Christians now necessarily or not necessarily that, just lawsuits in general?
Well, in general.
Okay.
As a scenario, a friend of mine had a baby, and there was a medical problem afterwards, and they sent her home anyway, and she nearly bled to death and had to have two blood transfusions.
Mm-hmm.
And they just went after the hospital for their medical bill solely, and they could have pursued a lawsuit.
Right. Okay. Let me make the distinction there. I just thought of four categories here. One, you mentioned revenge. So we have a lawsuit now that is being used where the law is being employed to exact revenge against somebody else. Now, even though one may have a legal case, that is, the action itself is not immoral. You could argue that there is a legitimacy to lawsuits individually, and they're not wrong in themselves. But even though it's not wrong in themselves, it can be advanced for a wrong reason or with a wrong motive or with a wrong intent. And so there's a couple of different things that can spoil an action, as it were, and make it immoral. Even if the action is legal, and some people say, well, what I'm doing is legal. I got my rights. Yeah, but look at why you're doing it. You're doing it to get back at somebody. This is a revenge motive. And as you pointed out, Tracy, revenge is not an appropriate motive for anything that we do. Okay? So if one is seeking after a lawsuit legitimately, as far as the law is concerned, but doing so with the motive of revenge, then they're outside the pale, as far as I'm concerned. It's wrong to do that. Now, it also might be that people are using lawsuits to steal. All right?
Uh-huh.
Or something akin to that. That is, some person trips on somebody's doorstep and then stubs his toe or something silly like that. You hear these crazy stories like when a thief comes in to steal from your house and slips on water in the dark room and breaks his arm and then sues the people who own the house for negligence even though he is breaking and entering and there to steal and collects.
Right.
To me, these things, though supported by the law, are examples of using law to steal. So that's a lawsuit that accomplishes theft, and I think that also would be wrong. There could be lawsuits, however, that are there to recover damages. If someone has damaged you, you have a legitimate expectation to have them pay for those damages.
But going beyond the damages, so say they pay for the company pays for the medical bills, going above and beyond and asking for extra money.
Well, damages could entail not just the bills, but the grief and hardship and difficulty that the negligence of this other party has caused. So I think that you could go beyond just the hospital bills legitimately. However, I think there are limits to that because I think you could have something reasonable, or you can say, I want $10 million. Okay, I'll settle for $5 million. You ask for $10 million, you figure you get half. So $5 million. Well, look, there's nobody's effort and difficulty and hardship is worth $5 million. This is an example of using a legitimate tool, a lawsuit, to not only collect legitimate damages but also to steal. And so when it goes that far, I think then it's beyond the pale.
So biblically, you don't think it would be unethical for a Christian to want some monetary compensation for emotional grievances?
I think that there, biblically, I don't know if I can answer that question. I don't know any place in the Bible that prohibits lawsuits, per se. I think there are restrictions when it comes to a lawsuit with another Christian, 1 Corinthians somewhere it says. But with regards to lawsuits in itself, somebody might be able to find something in the Old Testament law that gives us some insight into this, but it seems to me that there were compensatory damages that were collectible even under the Old Testament law, and there were damages not just for immediate expenses but for something more long-term. So I think that there is a legitimacy there as long as it doesn't get disproportionate
right.
to the harm that was caused.
Right.
But I also think that there is a thing called punitive damages. This punitive damages are things that are awarded to somebody in a suit like this because they mean to punish the person who has committed the offense. Now, this isn't the individual taking revenge. This is when the jury presumes, because of the nature of the crime, that this was so, or the negligence, because of the nature of the negligence, that the person has to be punished by the state, and the way the state punishes a person under these circumstances is takes more money from them, and it may turn out that the injured party gets the money if the jury decides for that. But that's an act of the state properly punishing according to statute. So I would say that when the motive is revenge or theft, that is immoral. When the motive is appropriate damages, as I characterized it, broader than just paying the hospital fees,
mm-hmm.
and or a legitimate and appropriate punitive action, then I think it's acceptable. I have no reason to believe in the Bible otherwise, and if there is, then I'd be glad to be corrected, but I don't think that that's the case.
Okay.
Does that help, Tracy?
That helps a lot. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your call. Let's see. Break time, right? Okay, 1-800-227-5278. 754-4150 in the 714 area code, and lines open. Talk to you in just a moment here on Stand to Reason.
Tired of defending your faith with "the Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-making and the will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Basic training for your mind, ladies and gentlemen. That's what you get here every weekend on Sunday, 3 to 5. You can actually get the fat out of your thinking and trim down to fight and weight here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host. Let me make a movie recommendation. I don't make these too often, partly because most of the movies that I end up seeing, we've had a bad run of them, it seems like. You know, just what is that all about? What a waste of money that was. Even when we get videos, we've had to take some back. But we saw a film that was a major release just recently that we liked tremendously. Now, I have to offer some qualification there because there is a little violence in this film. But this was really an exceptional film, well-acted, and very touching for me personally. Although it did do well at the box office. The title is Cinderella Man. Renee Zellweger, the female lead, and Russell Crowe, the male lead. It's a story about Jim Braddock, a boxer during the Depression, who did pretty well, then did pretty poorly, and then kind of made a comeback. And it's a biopic of sorts where you look at the inside of his life and see the struggles that he had as a human being. Both Zellweger and Crowe did an exceptional job. It's too bad Russell Crowe is such a cad off the screen. But he's so good on it. He's just in this characterization, just a treat to watch and quite touching. In fact, there's a scene there. Remember, they're going through the Depression and things are hard. They're bad and they have nothing. In fact, it's good for many of us to see what it was like for many of our parents who lived during that time. My folks did, and what they had to contend with. But there was a scene there where one of his children steals something. And he has to, even though they're nearly starving, and he has to deal with this child. And it's really worth the price of the film to see that short clip and how he does that. So I didn't know how this ended, by the way. It's a true story, and it's about the World Heavyweight Championship. And so I didn't know how it was going to end, and I'm not going to tell you. But it was quite a build-up and a quite a satisfying ending. And in fact, what was most important to me and most touching wasn't the ending, that is, the climax of the story, but the, for lack of a better word, the afterword, what we see of this man's life as he lived it out for the rest of his years. And there, you know, how they do that at the end, they have a couple of paragraphs, and they say, here's what happened. I just could not stop sobbing. It was so deeply touching to me. And I don't want to get your hopes too far up, but I think it's worthwhile. And if you're looking for a good movie to see, if you can find it, I don't know if it's even in general release anymore. I think it's just about gone. But certainly when it comes out in DVD, give it a rent. I think you won't be disappointed. I did mention this is a fighting movie. There are fights in it, and the fights are somewhat bloody. I mean, it's fighting. Okay, so you figure it out. If you got little kids that you don't want them to watch fighting, then don't let them watch this, but it's fine for adults. And I don't think there was a swear word in the entire movie. So it's pretty neat. Back to the phones here, that Cinderella Man, Russell Crowe, we're seeing. Back to the phones, and Paul, I thank you for waiting, sir.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I understand you're out here in Colorado not too recently.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, and in 2 days I'll be back out again.
Did you get a chance to do any fishing out here?
No, I don't usually have enough time for that, but I did take a hike up to the top of a big hill. Are you familiar with Manitou Springs?
Very much, yeah.
You know the Red Hill right there, or the Red Mountain, or whatever they call that? It's a promontory that kind of overlooks Manitou. And
okay.
You, right out of the summit house, you can catch the trail, and in 45 minutes you're at the top, and you get a beautiful picture of the whole valley below. But it's a huffer for a 55-year-old guy like me, so I'm out of breath, but it's good exercise, so that's what I do.
I'm from sea level.
Pardon me?
Especially when you come from sea level.
When I come from, yeah, it's absolutely right. It's three steps and a breath, three steps and a drink and a rest and a snooze and a nap, and then I take a couple, three more, you know.
Greg, I got a question for you today about what it means to have faith. My brother-in-law was diagnosed with cancer, and he's a pretty young guy, and my mother-in-law firmly believes that God will heal him. I believe that God, of course, can heal him, and if God doesn't heal him, that God has a purpose for that and that God will turn it to good. But I read through the Bible, and I see people that when they were seeking healing from Jesus, they weren't looking in kind of academic – their faith wasn't academic anymore. You know, you look at the guys who lowered – a man through the roof in Luke 5:19, and they didn't believe that Jesus just could heal him. They had the firm conviction that he would, and the woman touching his cloak in Matthew 9:20, she fully believed that Jesus would heal him, not that he just could.
Right.
So I guess what I'm asking is, am I not exercising the right kind of faith if I don't?
Yeah, let me talk about this a little bit. It's a very important question, Paul, and I do think there's a lot of confusion about this. I think we have to be aware when we are reading the life of Jesus that we have to be aware of a few things when we seek to interpret those passages, okay? For example, it's a narrative. It's not a didactic kind of teaching where you kind of have propositional statements. Here's the way it is, and this is what you believe and how you act and all that. This is what Jesus said and did and what other people said and did. And so it's sometimes more difficult in that genre to decide whether this is the kind of way we all should be or is this an exceptional circumstance or whatever. I agree with you that most of the people who went to Jesus were deeply convinced that Jesus was certainly able to do this and that he probably would if he can get their attention. All right?
Okay.
Not all of them, clearly not all of them, presumed he would. You know, when the Gentile, the Roman centurion sent his servants, and he said, basically, look, I'm a man under authority. I say do this or do that, and people do it. I know what it's like to be in command. You're in command, so I'm asking you, will you help me?
Okay.
Well, it wasn't a presumption that Jesus was going to do it, but he certainly knew that Jesus could. I think in the case that you cited with the woman with the issue of blood, for 17 years or whatever it is, and those that lowered the man down through the roof, I think they were pretty convinced that this was something that very likely could produce a healing in their case. Although it's interesting with the man with the paralytic lowered through the roof, Jesus he didn't address the physical healing first. You know that, don't you?
Yes, he says, friends, your sins are forgiven.
Your sins are forgiven, you know. And so eventually he does heal the guy. Now, I think that it is understandable for each one of those people to trust Jesus to do that with a high degree of expectation, principally because when Jesus was in his earthly ministry, he was very free with signs and attesting wonders. In other words, he was doing these things pretty regularly as to meet the human need, but also as evidence of the truthfulness of the claims he was making. He's the Messiah.
Right.
And so he's coming in messianic power. And since he's healing all kinds of people all the time, this increases the expectation that the people will be healed when they come to Jesus.
Okay.
So I think it's entirely – you're right that many of them anticipated the healing. And I think part of the reason that they anticipated is not because they thought Jesus could, not just because of that, but because they thought he actually would. And they thought that because he was healing all kinds of people that would come to him. Okay? Now, the question is that the appropriate expectation for people today? Is it the case that whoever comes to Jesus gets healed? Well, the answer to that clearly to me is no.
Right.
And so if we have our faith is Jesus will heal us, well, then it seems to me that there's a certain kind of presumption that's there.
And I guess I have to look at what the outside world has to see when they see people saying, well, I believe God will heal him, and then if he doesn't get healed, then it looks like just a bunch of wishful thinking.
Yeah, well it seems to me that if somebody really has a strong faith that God will heal, and then he doesn't heal, it means that they believed amiss. You know, God, it's one, look at, faith is trust. Real faith is actual trust, okay? You can actually trust very genuinely and completely and fully somebody to do something that they choose not to do. Just because you trust in that way doesn't mean that something magical happens. It's not mechanistic. It's not like pulling the lever with a certain amount of strength, and if you can get the lever down, then you get the money or you get the candy bar or whatever. God's not a machine. He's a person. So you put your trust in him and make your request, and under some circumstances, maybe you have a high level of confidence that this is actually going to take place because it's happening all around you, and every time people come to God for this thing, it seems like he responds. Well, that would increase my faith. That is my aggressive trust that he would act in this way. But it doesn't guarantee it. And I think there are occasions in the scriptures where we see people understood that this going to Jesus wasn't guaranteeing anything, but it was likely that he would respond, and in many cases he did. By the way, remember the Syrophoenician woman who had the daughter who was demon-possessed? You know, she had a kind of bandy back and forth with Jesus a little bit before he finally responded to her. He said, well, I don't give the children's food to dogs. And he's speaking of the children were the Jews, and the dogs here was the pejorative for Gentiles. No, I don't think he was referring to her as a dog. I don't think he was – what I think he was doing is he was parroting the bigotry of the Jews at that point. And she says, well, even the dogs eat the crumbs underneath the table. And, of course, the Jews were throwing the crumbs off the table. That is, they were rejecting Jesus. It was a very clever response. And he said, okay, you got me there. And he responds. And so basically he does not fulfill the bigotry of the Jews. He does help the Syrophoenician woman. But she's coming to him with great confidence, but she's not certain that he's going to act. She is certain that he can.
Okay.
And this is what gives her the confidence to aggressively pursue him the way she does.
Okay.
So I think you have a mixed bag even in the textual accounts in the Gospels. Now, I want to draw your attention to Hebrews 11. This is the faith chapter after all, right?
Okay.
Are you familiar with this passage?
I have to admit ignorance.
That's okay. Well, go home tonight or right after we're done talking.
Okay.
Read chapter 11, and while you're at it, let me just check something here. Read chapter 12. What the heck? Two chapters, all right?
Got it.
And what chapter 11 is about faith, and it's about what faith is and how it's expressed through people. And you will notice, and just make a note here, verse 35, and I want you to make note of the phrase, and others.
Okay.
And what you're going to discover is how many people exercised faith and were rescued, and some exercised faith and by faith were not rescued, and others were not rescued, basically, you see in that list. So here you can be faithful and get a response, and you can also, by faith, endure and persevere, even though God says no to that which you requested.
Okay.
And this ties in, I think, with something in Hebrews 12, which talks about God disciplining us and building us and developing us. So give attention to that. It's very clear to me in Hebrews 11 that legitimate faith does not – or faith is not always legitimized by its expected result. Your faith that God would heal is not legitimized – simply when you're healed. It could be a very legitimate faith, even if you're not healed, if, and here's a distinction that may be helpful, if it's your faith in rather than faith that. And I'm making, these are distinctions I'm making with my words here, the difference in these prepositions. My faith is in Jesus regardless of what happens. I say, God, please do this for me. Come through for me, heal me, provide me with this. I am trusting you actively. Now it's up to you to decide whether or not in your wisdom you think this is the right thing to do or not for me. I'm going to do all I can to pray that up and make it happen, but prevail upon you in prayer. But ultimately it's God's decision. So I'm not having faith that God will heal me. I'm having faith in Jesus to do what's best for me.
Okay.
Do you see the distinction? Because if I have faith that God's going to heal and he doesn't heal, guess, you know, then my faith is a failure. My trust has been misplaced and God let me down.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
That's why it's important to have faith in, and that's, I think you see this distinction here. Faith in God delivers in Hebrews 11, and faith in God perseveres in spite of lack of deliverance.
Okay.
Fair enough?
Yes.
Okay, Paul,
Thanks, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's good to have you call. Time to go to break. Again, 1-800-227-5278 is the number. Lines open in the 714 area code 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel, back in just a moment. Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Stand to Reason, the place to get a well-furnished mind. I'm Greg Coakley, your host. Contending for the Christian worldview. Coming into this segment with Keith Green. Just a tremendous, absolutely tremendous musician. I actually saw Keith Green perform. Keith Green, now dead 23 years. Can you believe that? No, 23. I was in Thailand. Because I was in Thailand. That's how I – see, the enforcer is amazed that I can remember things from that far back because my memory is so goofy. But I was in Thailand, and I heard about it. And I heard about it a couple of months after he died. You know, somebody sent me a letter that took a long time to get over there. This before email. And I was doing missionary work over there, working with Cambodian refugees in Thailand. And the letter said, of course, you heard that Keith Green has died, and that just really upset me. But I had listened to Keith a lot before that, and I liked a lot of his music, still have it, and actually heard him before he even was a Christian. And then after he became a Christian, he did the wedding for a friend of mine soon after he became a Christian. Then he just exploded in sensational ways with exposure and influence, which is great. All right, let's go back to the phones, and is it Mammy, Manny? I'm sorry, I can't read it. Help me out here.
That's Manny.
Okay, Manny, I'm sorry.
How's it going, Greg?
It's going fine. Thanks for your call today.
Oh, yeah, well, I just want to tell you, I've been listening to you since 1989, and you've been real influence in my Christian walk, and I really appreciate it.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks.
Hey, but my question was, I go to a church over here in La Mesa called Journey Community Church, and Mark Ostreicher, I guess he calls it his home church.
No kidding. Mark Ostreicher is the current president of Youth Specialties.
Exactly.
Following Mike Iaconelli, who is, I think, the founder of it. Mike died last year in a tragic accident. But Youth Specialties, just for people to understand the context here, is, I think, the number one youth training ministry in the country. They train massive numbers of youth leaders, and they have gone aggressively postmodern on us and emergent church. And Mark Ostreicher, I've read some of his blogs, to me is an example of that. In fact, I read Mark Ostreicher's blog about a month or so ago. He goes by Marco,
right,
in his blog, and he was the guy, for the listener's sake here, who said that the questions are always more important than answers. As a Christian leader, as a teacher, when we go out, our job is to ask questions, not to give answers. And this was a stunning absolutely stunning statement by him, and it was made on the heels, or it was in the midst of his attendance at the Emergent Church Conference in Nashville, Tennessee, where Brett Kunkel was also attending. Brett will be here next week interviewing Dan Kimball.
Yeah,
talking about
interesting
that.
Because I've also been in email contact, and he said, you know, read some of Dan Kimball's and then Brian McLaren's readings, because he wanted, because I kind of expressed kind of some of the concerns, you know, about this Emergent Church.
To Marco.
To Marco, basically, and the things that he said at the service were really troubling to my wife and I. And I guess my question is, my wife and I were trying to figure out, hey, you know, what should we ask you? But in our church, our concern is, you know, how long do we stay in a church, or what questions should we ask the pastors? What's our role as believers in a church that's maybe kind of leaning this way? Because Journey, I would say, it is a seeker-friendly church.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that not all churches are going to be perfect. And I have to tell you, our teaching pastor has been, you know, he's pretty right on. They don't necessarily teach topical or I mean, you know, verse mm-hmm. to verse, but he generally, I think, with a discerning heart, really is right on biblically, if you know what I mean.
Okay, well, I got a couple questions then. I don't know what Mark Ostreicher said at this meeting, and it might be good to look at the particulars, if you can get a tape and go over that, and isolate those things that you're concerned with. I think it would also be good to go to his website and see some things he's written on, so that when you see something that troubles you that he said there, you can draw back on some other information that he's written or he's published on that makes it clear that he did not misspeak here, that he was not it wasn't a lapse of care, or but that he's expressing what it sounded like at the time he was actually saying. In other words, he holds this view, whichever view it is that you think is a concern.
Right.
And so kind of get the goods. And I don't mean, okay, you're gonna, it's a gotcha kind of thing. But the point is, if you have somebody you're concerned with, you want to be very, very careful to get their view correctly and not to misrepresent them, to read them charitably where possible. But if they're speaking clearly things that are wrong, then I think it's fair to raise these questions, because your pastor let Mark Ostreicher pastor his church in this circumstance with this information.
Right, and that's what one of my concerns was, you know, okay, our church actually allowed, you know, Marco, and he's done it in the past, but I think that now he's so much, as you have kind of alerted to me, that's why, I mean, I think it was about a couple of months ago you kind of started making, I guess, us aware of this Emergent movement. I went immediately to websites and started looking. Oh, my goodness,
yeah.
this is a huge thing.
Right.
So, but one of the concerns I had was, like, my wife had noticed at the end, you know how a lot of churches give invitations? There was no mention, like, in the invitation, you know, you can say these words, like, I am a sinner, I need a Savior. It was almost like, you know, if you like the cool things that Jesus is all about, love, join the love wagon. And if you want to join this, raise your hand. And my wife and I were like, whoa, this is
that kind of stuff troubles me. And it isn't so much that there's got to be a pat or specific kind of sinner's prayer, but if you're going to make an appeal to be involved in the body of Christ, to be involved with Jesus, it's got to be the right kind of appeal. And what I always go back to, and I think there's variations on this, and I don't think every time it's got to be exactly the same. But for crying out loud, if you're a church committed to the Great Commission and making disciples, you communicate the gospel. And so you look in the book of Acts. I think if you go on our website, you can find my research on this. The gospel in the book of Acts, I think, is the preaching of the gospel in the book of Acts is the piece that I put together. But you can skim read yourself and find every time the gospel is preached. I found 13 occasions, and look at what was said. And there was none of this join the love wagon kind of thing. In fact, did you know that the word love is never mentioned a single time in the whole book of Acts?
I did know that.
Love is not a factor in the preaching of the gospel in the book of Acts. And that's a stunner. I didn't expect to find that, but when I did, I just dropped my teeth. I couldn't believe that. That wasn't their message. It wasn't have a relationship with God. It wasn't join the love wagon. It wasn't God loves you. It was, you know, or to paraphrase the four spiritual laws, it was a lot more like God hates you and has a hell of a plan for your life, you know. Because they gave the bad news. Now, my question is just simply this. If we have a habit of characteristically presenting the gospel one way, and the disciples characteristically presented it in an entirely different way, who's making a mistake here?
Right.
This isn't rocket science, for goodness sake.
Right.
So, and my conviction is, what I've seen is that, broadly speaking, seeker-sensitive churches have become seeker-centered churches, and those that do end up watering down the gospel, such that it becomes more like this thing you just described. And there are exceptions to this, and for anybody listening, I am not talking about Rick Warren. This isn't a veiled attack on Mr. Warren. I'm talking about secret churches in general, and if the shoe fits, wear it. I just have seen a lot of secret churches go down this road, and you, what you've just offered is a perfect example of what my concern is.
Okay, because I guess, you know, really, my wife and I have been talking. We were driving around, you know, waiting for you, me to get on the radio, and we're like, okay, what do we do?
You know, you can listen to the radio in your home. It's not against the law here, you know. Just
well,
sit at home and
do it. I was coming to wash her car because we actually just came back from a week fishing in the Sierras.
Oh, okay,
and
good
so
for you.
I think I'm going to convince my wife that she's going to try fly fishing. So we're going to go back and do some fishing.
All right, good for you.
But anyways, I thank you for your words, and I think what I'm going to do is I also appreciate this 4-point thing because I have to actually respond to Marco, and I'm going to say, you know what, can you give me your views on the 4 things that you said?
Yes. Do you remember what
college?
You remember what they were then, right?
Yeah. Let me see. What is your concept of truth and knowledge?
Yes.
Is the idea of Bible, is it inerrancy or is it
what's your view of the Bible, right?
And the Great Commission.
The cross was the third one.
Yeah.
Yeah, did you get that? And in other words, does their view entail, at least include, the idea of substitutionary atonement? Did Jesus die for me? If that's
right.
What was going on, is his death paid for my sins? Now, there may be other things going on the cross, you know, Christus Victor, showing God's love or God's hatred of sin, all kinds of stuff. But does it at least entail this sense of substitutionary atonement? And then finally, what is the Great Commission? Do people have to hear the gospel to be saved? I mean,
right.
Is this, you know, is this some kind of pluralism that you hold? These, to me, are the watershed questions.
Right, and there's, and, you know, one last thing he was saying, that, you know, in a seeker-sensitive church, he would talk about, like, we are the beloved. Well, I would say as a believer, I'm a part of the beloved. But as a person who's not a believer, they wouldn't be a part of the beloved.
No,
of course. Distinction.
You know, if you're not a believer, look, God's pretty mad at you right now. You know,
yeah,
and that's the state. And this is why when you go back to the book of Acts, and see, I'm going to use the scripture in this, and that's why, and I think that's for us the place for us to stand. Oh, well, let me know what you find out, and you can ask Mark Ostreicher those specific questions, and let's just see. And don't let him be a weenie on this and kind of weasel out of it, all right?
I will. And would you be interested in having, like, a CD of his 2 messages?
To be honest with you, there's a time problem for me. What I'd rather have Manny, have your conversation with him and then get back to me and tell me what you found out, okay?
Excellent. Thank you very much. God bless you, buddy.
Well, thank you so much. Good talking to you. Okay, let's talk with Eric, and Eric's got an update on the Mormon issue, right? The Mormon and Mariner. Whoops, I said that church, didn't I?
Uh-oh.
Sorry about that. Okay, this big church in Southern California that has opened its parking lot so that Mormons and Mormon visitors to the new temple can park there while they go to the temple and get evangelized by the Mormons.
Yeah, Greg, I just was listening to the first part of your show from last week, and I thought I should call in and tell you that I was out there all week from mm-hmm. Saturday to yesterday, and one of the strategies we had to kind of...
Who is we here, Eric? Now, just to let the folks know, you're not one of the Mariner pastor, the church's pastors, are you?
No, I should explain.
I
associate with Mormonism Research Ministry,
right.
Christian
mm-hmm.
outreach to both Mormons as well as trying to inform Christians about what Mormonism teaches.
This is Bill
of this church.
Bill McKeever's organization?
It is.
Yeah.
Their own records say that 30% rise in their church membership in an area that would take place within the next 2 years. And they have 50,000 LDS in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime there's a temple opening, we like to be there with a 4-page informational newspaper.
So wait, they're anticipating, let's see, 50,000, 30% would be 15,000, an increase of 15,000 in their membership in the next few years because they've opened a new temple in Irvine.
Oh, and you go through
Newport.
The temple, you'll see why, because they'll get your name and address. They will have you sign up not only just to have a basic card signed, but also they will have you get genealogical work, and mm-hmm. you should have seen all the people putting their names and address mm-hmm. and giving it to them. And so, yeah, they have the missionaries there. In fact, I talked to one of the people in there, and they said our missionaries will be busy for the next year with all these.
Wow. So just to – Eric, we got about 2 minutes. I'm sorry for the brevity here. But, of course, the concern that you have and what I've raised is that here is a church that in a I think a right-hearted sense of being neighborly to the LDS in a wrong-headed way is – contributing to the evangelistic effort that could bring thousands of Mormons into the Mormon church.
It's a shame. We've had contact with them. We've talked to them, and they've explained kind of what you explained on the show last week. We had to change our strategy completely. So what we are doing now, we just bought over the weekend a site called sacredorsecret.com.
Right.
And we put together a site that actually would allow people to be able to see what the differences are. We have had over almost 400 hits from one sign that I held out there throughout 12 hours a day for the past week. People were very curious about that and wanted to see what that was.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're getting a lot of information out that way. But I just wanted to call, too, if any of your listeners who live anywhere in the area want to help, I wanted to be able to give them an opportunity to be able to not only stand out there. We have, when we've had enough people, which wasn't very often last week, we had somebody even at the church at the exit outside on public property trying to give out newspapers. It was very hard to do, but if we had the people, we would be able to put...
Eric, how do people get in touch with you?
Let me give my email address, and then I would put you in contact with the person up there.
Okay.
And I'll kind of filter through.
Go ahead. We got 60 seconds here, Eric.
ERJ@MRM.org. That's Mormonism Research Ministry.
ERJ@MRM. Mormon Research
ORG. Yeah.
.org. Well, that's an easy one. ERJ@MRN.M.
MRM, Mormonism Research Ministry.
My error. Thank you. And I was trying to help things. I just made it more confused. But
thank you, Greg, for your show last week, and I appreciate what you have to say. You have wise things to say, and you're right on with this issue.
Thank you so much. And you keep up the good work over there. And to me, it was very frustrating that though there was a desire to be neighborly to help the LDS do their evangelism, which isn't the way the Mariners Church views it, but this is what it amounts to. There wasn't the same sense of openness and neighborliness to folks like you who wanted to give the other side, as it were, in a gracious way. And so if you folks would like to help Eric and the others to do that, if you have an interest in this kind of thing, go to ERJ, or rather write an email to ERJ@MRM, Mormonism Research Ministry, as that what stands for, .org, ERJ@MRM.org. Eric, thanks a lot for the call and the update, and that's all the time we have for this. 2 hours went pretty fast, didn't it, friends? Next week, Brett Kunkel with Dan Kimball, leader in the Emergent Church. Brett will be hosting the show, and he'll be interviewing Dan as well as taking your calls afterwards. So I will be on the Alaskan cruise and then be back after that. In the meantime, be a good ambassador for Christ and give him heaven. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.